Hey, thanks for joining me again. This is episode 67, and I'm talking with Rae Pika. She is a keynote speaker, podcaster, author, and educational consultant. She has some extremely cool experiences in her work background. For example, she worked in the research department at Sesame Street for a while, as well as on the TV show Blue's Clues. She's an expert on bringing physical movement into the classroom. But today we're talking about her latest book, What If Everybody Understood Child Development? A topic that's near and dear to my heart. The book is chock full of awesome information. You're going to love it. Be prepared to have your brain set on fire and only want to know more. Enjoy.
They're not here for us. We're here for them. That's what it's about. Kids.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is all about assisting classroom teachers and school administrators to overcome the many walls or barriers that kids face. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is focused on helping you help kids achieve their dreams. As a note, I hope that you will stop by Stitcher or iTunes and leave me a star rating and a comment. That helps the show get noticed by more people. Thanks for listening and joining me week after week.
Welcome to the Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 podcast, bringing you ideas and resources for K-12 classrooms, schools, and school districts. Hosted by Steve Mileto. And now, here's Steve with this week's show.
Hey, welcome back to another exciting episode of Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12. I'm your host, Steve, and today I'm with Rae Pika. Rae is an educational consultant, author, keynote speaker, and co-founder of the BAM Radio Network, where she hosts her podcast, Student Centricity. She's the author of 19 books, including Experiences in Movement and Music, Great Games for Young Children, and Jump into Literacy, as well as many others. Her latest edition is What If Everybody Understood Child Development? She has worked with many different organizations, such as the Sesame Street Research Department and Nickelodeon's Blue's Clues. She also blogs for the Huffington Post and is a member of the Executive Committee of the Academy of Education Arts and Sciences. Say hi to everybody, Rae.
Hi, everybody, and hello to you, Steve. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today and with me. And I got to tell you, we're going to get into the book and everything in just a minute, but I also got to say this, and I forgot to mention this ahead of time. So, I got to go back to this is cool. You worked with the research department at Sesame Street, and also did some work with Blue's Clues. Can we just start with that? Because that's so neat. Because my children are now in college, and Blue's Clues, I spent a lot of time with that, and of course my own personal time as a kid with Sesame Street and with them as they got older. But can we just kind of start there? I think that's pretty neat that you
sure
had that in your background.
Absolutely. Well, I've consulted a couple of times for the Sesame Street Research Department, and the first time was just harrowing. I mean, it was back in the day when they had the magazine, so all the magazine writers were there, the video people were there, the writers for the show, and there were a handful of us consultants there, and they were picking our brains about whatever the topic was at hand. I think games was the theme for one season, and so I was there to pitch my little speech about no competition and how it should be, you know, all about working together, cooperation at that age, and it didn't go over well with everyone, but I was really, really, really nervous waiting for my turn. But it was absolutely an honor to do that. And speaking
awesome.
Of honors, we're actually honoring Sesame Street with a special achievement award at the BAMMies this year in September.
Cool.
So, yeah. And then Blue's Clues is fun to have on the resume. They asked me to review a script that involved movement. So I did that for them. And, you know, if they're listening, I'm happy to do more.
Nice. That is awesome. I had, you know, big fans of those shows, and it's interesting to hear that how you worked with them and consulting about the movement and so forth. And, you know, Blue's Clues obviously was one of those that if you know, asking the kids to be involved in what's going on the screen, which was what's really cool about it. And so neat stuff. So fit right into your realm. Let's move from there and just talk about you've been an educational consultant. You've written numerous books. How did you go about what made you think that being an educational consultant is what you wanted to do?
It wasn't. I just sort of followed this path, you know. I was asked first to teach dance to preschoolers, and I thought, oh, sure, I'll give that a try. And then I was asked a few years later by a local Head Start organization if I would come do some PD for them and around movement stuff. And I said, oh, sure, I'll give that a try. And you know, I kept saying yes to these opportunities. And the next thing I knew, I was an educational consultant. It just seems like it was meant to be, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. Sometimes that's how it works out. I had to start there because that's just, I always wonder how, I like to ask the questions, how people got into their, what becomes their career field. And so that's neat. That's
there are very few people I know who actually know from the get-go when they're young what they wanted to be. I knew I wanted to be a writer, so that part has come true because that's in my genes. You know,
gotcha.
Definitely a family thing. So, but other than that, you know, life has turned out to be rather unexpected.
Nice. I know I'm somebody who, as a kid, I wanted to be a fighter pilot, yet I don't do well on roller coasters. I'm not quite sure how that, you know, that's one of those life changes, those life focuses that you realize after a while, that's not the right direction for me.
I love it.
Well, let's shift. Let's talk a little bit here about, you know, it's easy to tell that you have a focus on the importance of physical activity in school and teaching just by simply looking at the titles of your books. Let's talk about that focus a little bit.
Sure. As I said, I just sort of fell into these things. I followed this path. We couldn't afford dance lessons, you know, for me when I was a kid. And so I took my first dance lessons when I was 24. And it just literally changed the course of my life. While doing that, as I said, somebody asked me, oh, would you teach, you know, our preschoolers dance? And I said, oh, sure, I'll try that. And then I realized very quickly that they didn't need dance technique at 4 and 5 as much as they needed, you know, your basic body and spatial awareness, some opportunities for creative self-expression and that sort of thing. So I started studying movement education, and it just swallowed me whole. I guess it just really resonated with me. And it started off, you know, just about the physical and the creative piece as well. But as I continued on, I began to understand how physical activity related to all of the domains of child development, you know, not just physical, but also social, emotional, and cognitive, which is the piece most people don't really consider. So, it just became a passion for me over the years, and I don't feel any less passionately about it now.
Which is definitely apparent, because that's the theme of most of your books, and including this latest one has a section in the middle of it where it gets into the need for the physical activity. So, well, let's just kind of run with that just a little bit, and because what is it that you see as a challenge that happens in the classroom or so forth to incorporate? What is it that I don't know, what kind of prevents it, or is it a lack of understanding that it should be incorporated? I mean, what is it you find is the challenge to having the physical activity?
It's a wonder to me how much research we have that shows the connection between moving and learning, you know, between the brain and the body. And yet people still think of children, and when I say people, I mean, you know, the policymakers and decision makers who really ought not to be making decisions about children. They seem to view children as existing only from the neck up, And you know, Descartes, the philosopher, started this whole dualism when he said, I think, therefore I am. And I don't know, Steve, why it caught on, because it's so ridiculous to me, you know, the idea that the mind and body are separate entities, or right. why it's lasted as long as it has. But it's doing, I think, a great deal of harm to our children when we just consider, you know, the brains is the only thing that matters.
It is strange that it's become such a I mean, it's become just so embedded within our culture, and I'm not quite sure I understand that either, because, you know, as it's funny, you're constantly trying to rein in kids, especially the younger they are, when, you know, what they really need to be doing is trying to figure out how to take that energy and the desire to be moving and be up and doing things and figure out how to incorporate that instead of,
well, exactly, and it's getting worse, you know, and instead of preparing kids for school, we should be preparing schools for kids.
Nice.
I mean,
yeah.
Doesn't that make more sense?
It makes way more sense. I cringe every time that, because in our state, they've been talking over the last year about, and this is Georgia where I am, they've been talking about it, shortly they'll have these tests for kindergartners. And I'm like, oh my gosh. You know, it's like, let's not do that to them. We got, they shouldn't be stressing out over some standardized test. You know, there's so many activities and things they should be doing, and I don't think filling bubbles is one of them.
No, I'm with you 150%. It's just, you know, it's one of those things that turns my hair white, although I don't think it can get any whiter. But, if we just understood children, this sort of thing wouldn't even be proposed.
And that, I think, is what you just gave us a nice little segue right into this new book. I think that's, you know, actually where, you know, in the beginning of your book, and I'll go to that in just a second, you talk about that as it's just such a huge problem in our world today. Let me just use that as a shift into your latest book, which is called What If Everybody Understood Child Development? And like I said, I love this book. It's easy to understand, as well as it has helpful thoughts for teachers and links to resources. And in the introduction, you say, when I hear stories about teachers and administrators making decisions that create the impression they don't know children at all, I speculate about how different things might be if everyone understood child development. Can I get you to talk about that, what you mean? And I think you just kind of helped lead us right into that with what you just said.
Yeah, well, thank you, Steve. I really, really appreciate your kind words about the book. This is a very important one to me. It feels like a culmination of all of my years of work. But yes, I mean, you know, as you say in the introduction, I mentioned some of these stories that I've come across. The 7-year-old child suspended from school for biting his strawberry Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun. This is what children do. They play bang bang. You know, it doesn't mean we have to interrogate them as though they're terrorists, which is another story that I've come across. A little girl, you know, interrogated for 3 hours in the principal's office. It's appalling. And students not allowed to talk during lunch, you know, and where do they learn how to communicate? Where do they learn social skills? Where do they learn to be part of a community when this kind of thing happens? The children who have recess withheld from them, you know, for things that have absolutely, you know, nothing to do with recess.
Right.
And, you know, and as you said, the kindergartners and, well, the, we're trying to rein in children all the time, but if we just understood who children are and what they need, we wouldn't be doing things that are the opposite of what they
right.
need. We wouldn't be saying, sit still, sit still, sit still, when they are not meant to sit still. Mother Nature did not make them to sit still. So when I envision a world in which everybody understood child development, I envision much happier children. I envision school as a place of joy and authentic learning. You know, I envision much healthier children. Right now we have more children than ever on antidepressants and Ritalin, and I really have a hard time talking about these things because it's just so appalling to me. It feels like abuse.
Oh, I understand why. It is. I mean, you see the issues that people, adults trying to figure out how to help their child, but part of what the problem is the idea that they're being asked to do things that are really changing who they are as a human being, and it's the stages are so not understood. You know, it's when I was working on my dissertation, I had in my doctorate work, I used to do what the typical, well, at least what lots of my friends did in the doctorate work, which is get sidetracked by different things and had to be reined in once in a while. And I discovered a book by Francis Parker. I think he wrote it in like 1893 or something. And he, in the first chapter, and this might sound, it's called like Talking About Pedagogy or something like that as a title. And he said, in the first six pages, he says something like the worst, like an enemy to education. It sounds a little more controversial than what it is if you read it, the rest of what he says, but he says the worst enemy to education is a teacher doesn't read. And when you read the rest of what he's talking about understanding children. He's talking about understanding who they are. And I think it's funny because this is written in the 1890s when I think they may have still been doing, lobotomies and things. And, maybe shock treatment, but
and you have to wonder, why no one was listening. I use a quote in my presentations that goes back to 1917, Alfred North Whitehead in The Aims of Education. He wrote, "I lay it down as an educational axiom that in teaching you will come to grief as soon as you forget that your pupils have bodies."
Wow.
Yeah, no one was listening to him either.
No, not at all. And that was 1910 or seven, did you say?
1917.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. It's very frustrating. Sometimes you just feel, maybe in other fields, but in education, we certainly feel occasionally as though we're just chasing our tails. So that's a big part of the reason why I felt the need to write the book.
And it's right on the money because, it's as a historian, one of the things that I'm very focused on and believe is that we become ahistorical. We tend to ignore some of the things of the past. And part of this is, this idea of understanding. We have too much research there to understand humans and human development, yet we're ignoring it. And and so what I'd like to do is use that as a segue into actually dive into your book. And I enjoy the whole book, but my favorite chapters are the first one, All Children Are Not the Same, the second one, The Earlier the Better, and chapter 24, The Homework Debate. Do you have any favorites? And if so, which ones and why?
Well, I have jokingly said before, don't tell my other books, but this is my favorite.
I won't tell them.
Mommy's not supposed to have favorites.
Right.
When I've been asked that question about the essays themselves, the chapters, it's hard to choose. I guess at this moment, maybe depending on what's happening in education or what stories I've come across lately, it's going to shift. But at this moment, why does sitting still equal learning is a big one for me. And then should we teach handwriting in the digital age? I keep coming across I come across the stories that talk about schools eliminating it from the curriculum, and then I come across research that tells us why it shouldn't be eliminated. Again, Mother Nature had a plan, and the hand is intricately linked to the brain. So that's one of my pet peeves at the moment. Tell me briefly, if you would, I'm going to interview you now, Steve. why chapters 1 and 2 are your favorites?
Well, first of all, this idea of all children are not the same. They're not the same. And you start off by saying, the idea that this should be, if we accept, I love what you say, if we accept the idea that every snowflake is different, why can't we accept this about children and try and focus on them as if they're all they all move through development the same way. And actually, I'll just read some of your words back at you. We got you say in that chapter, that means the standards must also be developmentally appropriate and based on the principles of child development designed with actual children in mind, but they're not. Standards are written by people with little to no knowledge of child development. And that statement in itself is why I love this chapter in the book, because what's happening in our world and is that, and this is really why I like this, is that the idea that all kids should move forward and go through stages all at the same time, and the idea that we're treating them that way, the idea that you have to be able to pass this test on this day at this time, and this is the information that you will know and understand by this time, like everybody's supposed to know how to read, talk, and speak, and walk all at the same time. And it's all this focus on thinking that kids are all the same. Well, it's not just with kids. It's, you know, it's part of the reason why as we get older, into adolescence, pre-adolescence, and even becoming adults, why there are some things that we do better at and others don't. And I think you really address that. And that's why I like this chapter, because it's something that I've often said to people. I coached youth. No, let me try that one again. I coached youth soccer for a long time, and I've coached kindergarten age kids all the way up to high school. And K through 12, basically. And what's interesting about it is that I was trained early on in youth soccer, where the soccer, he understood kids at the different stages, and he would talk to you about this. He evidently was an elementary teacher, and you could, any coach that had been trained by him, you knew, because we did certain things differently. It's amazing that, you know, just in a sport itself, there are going to be kids who have a hard time giving up the ball in the beginning, because that's part of their stage of development. trying to make them pass it is not going to happen, and you can't get mad at them because it's what they do. And some of them actually steal it from another teammate simply because they want the ball, because they know that it makes their parent and the coach happy if they put the ball in the net. And so you have to you can't overcome those stages. Instead, you kind of incorporate it, and you help them learn what they're doing and have fun and get out there and run around. And it's funny, because you'll also see kids that are at different stages. I've actually had, you know, first graders who understood the idea of trying to pass the ball. And by the way, that was awesome when you would get a young kid like that, because they're really way ahead of most of the other kids. My point is that this is why I love that chapter, is that it gets to this. We are in such a world where people do not know enough about child development, and they think that all kids are going to be the same, and it's just a matter of the teacher doing the right thing in the classroom, and then all of them are going to be excellent, as if they don't have some sort of baggage. I mean, if you talk about middle school age kids, I mean, they got so much stuff going on them physiologically. Did I say that word right?
Physiologically, yes.
Thank you. Yeah, they got so much stuff going on that it's just a wonder they can even pay attention in school at all.
Exactly. And then, you know, we start school at the crack of dawn, and everybody knows that the teens need more sleep, and that their brains don't really warm up until somewhere around lunchtime. And,
right.
You know, again, we don't prepare the schools for kids. But thank you for your kind words again. And, you know, what you're talking about is it's sort of been the situation with education always, right? I mean, we have kids in the same, well, except back in the day when we had multi-level classrooms, but we've got classes with kids pretty much all the same age, and we expect them to do all of the same stuff at the same time and to be at the same place when that grade ends and they go on to the next one. And it's just the craziest notion. And the Common Core standards for kindergartners, for example, state that all children will read by the time they leave kindergarten, and it's just an appalling notion. I mean, when you think about child development and the range, walking alone, you know, can go from somewhere around 8 months to 16 months. And so any time within that range is normal. We take the median, which is 12 months, right? Most kids are supposed to walk by a year. And if they don't, you know, parents start to panic. And it's the same way with reading. And you mentioned something earlier that reminded me, you know, the amount of misinformation parents are getting these days, and whether it's regarding Ritalin, the need for Ritalin, or what it might be. And it's just really It's horrible. I mean, what group of people is easier to scare than parents, right?
Yes.
Because they all want the best for their children, and they're getting so much information coming at them, and so much of it is incorrect. So, you know, anyway, moving on.
Okay, well, looking at chapter two, the earlier the better, and I love the statement, and the reason why I like this chapter is... you know, you say in there, child development cannot be accelerated. Moreover, there is no reason to try to accelerate it. And that just is, wow, that just kind of hits me like a nice cup of cold water. And and that is something that I think there too often what's happening is, and it kind of goes back to what you're talking about. You know, parents want the best for their kids, and so they're willing to listen to people who don't know. And, you know, the political arena is very focused on this idea that all we got to do is just drive it lower and lower and lower. Because that's going to make our kids better and better and better. And instead, it's just stressing them out, and you're trying to fit round peg. What's it? Square pegs into round holes? I think I may have just said the statement backwards. But anyway, you know, it's and that's that statement right there is the essence of chapter two. What you see this, you run into it too much, where it's the idea just keep pushing it down lower and lower and lower, and that means these kids are going to be so much better at whatever the skill is that they want them to be better at by a certain age.
It makes no sense whatsoever, you know, I don't really know. I guess because we have this idea that education is a race, that's why the politicians are doing the push down. Parents, it surprises me. How many times have you heard a parent say, oh, they grow up so fast, and yet...
Yes.
You know, they're enrolling them in competitive soccer programs at 18 months old, you know, and that's just only a slight exaggeration. You know, and they're learning four different languages, and,
right.
and they're doing everything they can to make them grow up. But you cannot make them grow up. You cannot hurry child development. It is what it is. And that's an expression I don't really like, but it is completely apt right here. It is what it is. And the only thing that we're doing is causing children to be afraid and frustrated, because, you know, they want so much to please the adults
yes.
in their lives.
Yes.
And if they see, you know, that passing the ball makes their parents happy, then they're going to try to pass the ball. But a preschooler can't think of two things at the same time.
Right.
So dribbling the ball while running is hard enough, but trying to run, dribble, and pass, I mean, forget it. You've seen that beehive soccer, right?
Yes.
Where they're all in a lump and they're following the ball.
Exactly.
And the parents are screaming and the coach is screaming from the sideline, you know, pass the ball, whatever. It's just not possible. It's just not possible. You know, the kid out in right field who's 5 years old would rather pick dandelions or find caterpillars in the grass or lie on his back and find creatures in the clouds
right.
than wait for that dang ball to come his way. And if the ball does happen to come his way and he is busy picking dandelions, then the adults are going to have a holy fit. And it's just not fair. It's not fair.
It definitely is not. And it is something that, you know, trying to accelerate everything is just amazing to me, that it just totally ignores, flies in the face of just watching kids as they, I guess, kind of driving the love of certain things out of their purview because too much is about doing it too soon. And
absolutely. Absolutely. On average, kids who start sports early quit at age 13. And the number one reason they quit is because it's just not fun anymore.
Which is really sad because it can
it
be
is.
So much fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's look at my other favorite was chapter 24, which is the homework debate, which as a former principal, I've had, and in my position now as a RESA director, where I work with my coach teachers and principals, one of the things that I've run into along the way is having a discussion about homework and is it necessary to give it. And one of the focuses one of the areas that I get, you know, into is the idea of, number one, you don't know who's doing the homework. and if a kid doesn't have help at home, you know, it's kind of like we've been involved in all kinds of different activities with the kids growing up, and one of those activities has these cars that you make as part of it, the Pinewood Derby cars. And it's funny when you see a kid car and then you see a car that looks like it was manufactured in Detroit. And, you know, it's like, wow. And not only is the paint job spiffy, but it also is so fast that it's going to fly out the door when it hits the bottom of the rails. And it's just, and it's the same way with homework. You have some of these issues. And I've talked with teachers about, why would you give 35 problems if you don't have time to grade them? And because feedback is so important. And, well, you know, it's all about teaching and responsibility, which, by the way, you get into that, which is another part of this that I love. You talk about that. And it just drives me nuts, because I'll say to him, let's push the responsibility thing aside for a minute, because I don't, I'm going to tell you, you're not doing that. But let's simply go to the idea that 35 a night, and you know, I actually had an adult tell me, and she was quite proud of herself. She said, well, I just choose randomly three of them because it makes them do them all. And I said, but what if they're doing them wrong? I said, they don't know which three you're going to do. And then they get frustrated because they don't know if they're doing them right. I said, that's the whole wrong attitude about what homework should be about. And, you know, right now I'm kind of picking on math and science teachers, but, you know, it can happen in all content areas where you're giving them stuff, you don't have time. I had a young man one time when I like telling this story. He was a hoot, and he was a 10th grader, and first time I had him, and I was focused on, in my world history class, on teaching them how to write responses to short answer questions leading them up to essays. I was working with an English teacher trying to help do this, and we had progressed from the short answer questions to the first essay, and he had this nice intro, and I can remember his closing was okay. But in the middle of it, he had written, Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, over and over and over again. And I'm like, what in the world? And I wrote, see me. And he came out to see me, and I said, can you tell me about your paper? And he's like, what? And I said, I remember this happening. He's probably like 35 years old now. And I remember it till the day, I can't think anymore, but I said, come on, tell me about your paper. And he's like, I don't know what you mean. And I said, yes, you do. And he goes, oh. He goes, did you read it? And I said, yeah.
Oh.
I said, yes, I read your paper. And I want to know why you wrote Mary had a little lamb over and over again in there. He goes, well, I've had people who don't grade them. I didn't think you were going to read it.
I was like, wow.
And that was so telling. I'm like, oh, my gosh. And so, you know, and that's, this is a bright kid who's telling me this, who's been taught that, you know, the homework just mattered about the size of it and whether you turned it in or not. So I think there's so many issues with homework that there shouldn't, like you say, there shouldn't really be a debate at all, because there's not really any evidence, especially in elementary school, like you say, whether there's any connection to it, correlation to achievement or not.
Yeah, it's the way it's always been done, and that is just not a good reason to do anything, especially if we have research showing that, you know, it isn't necessary. There's really no point to it. And for those who believe that it teaches responsibility and delayed gratification, again, the research on that is very, very slim. There are few people who agree with that statement. And don't kids get enough responsibility and delayed gratification during school hours?
Right.
And certainly, you know, if they need more, that's the parents' purview, I think.
I'm on that planet with you. that just gets into that whole thing, because the whole discussion about responsibility will drive me over the wall with I have a real difficult time when an adult tells me that. But we have if a parent tells me that, I meant a teacher tells me that, because that's a discussion that I had multiple times with people telling me that they can teach a child responsibility in the few hours that they have them in a day through a homework assignment. And I'm like, well, let's take a look, because if you give a kid a zero, does it make them do the homework more, or do they just stick it in their book bag and say, oh, well, I got a zero?
Right, right. And eventually that learned helplessness will set in, you know.
Yes.
They feel like they can't. Yeah. Can't get it right no matter what they do. Have you had any success, Steve, in turning some teachers around?
Some of them, yes, but I would tell you that once I left that building, they may have reverted, because I'm no longer there making them
yeah.
do it. And I would say that if I had success, it was because they already thought that they shouldn't be doing it. They must have already had thoughts about it, and they just simply needed some support, you know, against some other colleague or something like that, to say, I told you we shouldn't be doing it. But I would say that it's been very limited because, Mileto made me do it. That's why I'm doing it. And instead of wanting to look at the research, you're going, oh, don't say Mileto made you do it. Let's look at why you shouldn't be doing it. And you fight that battle a lot, and it goes down to not really taking the time to know what the evidence says about the subject.
Right, right.
So I wish I had a better story for you there than that.
I may use your Mary Had a Little Lamb story, though.
Please do. That was awesome because he wrote the whole little Mary Had a Little Lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. I mean, he wrote the whole little story over and over again, and very nicely too. Nice little neat handwriting because he figured the neater he wrote it, the more I was less likely to read it. I'm like,
oh gosh.
I also have to say this, by the way. In your book, you don't pull punches, and I like that too. Like in chapter two, you say. You talk about politicians pandering to the ridiculous notion that education is a race. And, you know, a little bit later you get into, in other chapters, you talk about the idea that that this is not acceptable and this is why and there's a lack of research and you don't pull punches. And I think that's something that teachers need to have more of, not just teachers, building administrators need to have more of, which is that type of writing that I like to talk about, you ever heard the saying, we need to stop drinking that juice or he drinks his own juice or whatever?
Mm.
And I think we too often, if it's said over and over again by the political arena or by some political pundits or whatever, it must be real. So therefore, we need to start talking that way.
Yeah, it becomes an urban legend or something. Yeah. And thank you for pointing that out, for saying that. You know, I didn't want to pull any punches. I wanted to be as blunt as the publisher would allow me to be and just... You know, just tell it like it is, or like I see it. I'm very, very brave in writing. Not quite so brave in person because my mind doesn't think quickly enough. You know, if only I had a mind like Robin Williams, I could get the answers out right off the top of my head. I'm not a very good debater, but when I have the chance to think about it and write it down, I'm going to tell it like it is. So sometimes I worry, Steve, that I'm too cynical. Maybe I've become even a pessimist in some ways. And I had to be reminded by the publisher to add that section on what's a teacher to do. And I'm very, very glad that Corwin suggested that because really, what is the point in my pontificating or, you know, pounding the desk with my own fists and not giving the teachers some way to help create change. So,
right. As a note, I do need to tell you that you made me squirm in my seat a few times when you're also giving it to the administrators.
I'm sorry.
All is good. All is good. I hope that I was not on that planet. It's got to be said because, like I was saying before, they hear too much of the other stuff, and so after a while it becomes what must be real, and it's not. It's just that it's said louder and more frequently, therefore, you know, so we got to figure out how to fight back against that. And that little what should a teacher do really helps because you give them ideas about how to deal with those situations.
Good.
Well, what I'd like to do is, because I'm keeping you so much here, and I appreciate your time, let's kind of shift out of the book then. Let's say that, if you had a chance to talk to 100 brand new teachers, they haven't set foot in their classroom yet, which is this time of year. And in the state of Georgia, we have teachers reporting right now, and a couple of them will have kids rather quickly. What advice would you give them about teaching? What's the one thing you would want them to know about?
Well, I do often get to talk to teachers when I give my keynotes. I don't know how many of them are brand new, but I guess I want them all to know. It would be wonderful to reach them before they set foot in the classroom and help them understand the connection between mind and body. You know, not to just consider the from the neck up and to realize that young children especially, a lot of us really need to physically experience concepts in order to understand them. And for those who worry about children bouncing off the walls, as you mentioned earlier, we're always trying to rein the kids in. Guess what? We wouldn't have to try so hard if we let them do what they're meant to do. You know, I mean, that doesn't mean, you know, letting them run rampant, you know, have control over the classroom and actually bounce off the walls. But moving kids are more likely to stay on task than kids who are asked to sit still. So that's a whole big answer there. I just would like them to understand the connection between mind and body, the connections, because there are so many, whether we're talking about the hand or the whole body.
Nice. So. That's awesome. Well, let's talk about the same scenario, but this time it's 100 principles. What advice would you give them? What one piece of advice?
Pretty much the same. Now, that I would love to have more opportunity to talk to principals. I really, really would. I think that if they and teachers understood the connection, if they understood the connection between mind and body, they would not be eliminating recess. We have research going back to 1880, Steve, and up to the present, showing that individuals, but especially children, because of their level of brain development, produce more when they have breaks. You know, in right. Finland, they give the kids 15-minute recess after every 45 minutes of instruction. This is what we need to be doing. So they wouldn't be implementing school-wide policies for no recess. So we've got to, you know, we have to have more time for academics and taking tests. And I was on a Twitter chat the other night, and a teacher was talking about the fact that the kids have 20 minutes for lunch, which, you know, means a lot of gobbling, right, and a lot of wasted food. And if they finish their lunch in time, they can have recess. I mean, this is ridiculous. So I'm beginning to ramble. I get all worked up here. And also relevant to recess, withholding recess as punishment is wrong on so many levels. First of all, it's not natural consequences. You know, a kid squirms. Well, that's the child who needs recess. A kid forgets homework. What does withholding recess have to do with that? What is it teaching him or her? And I see it as cruel and unusual punishment. So these are the messages that I would like to get to both teachers and principals and whoever is making the decisions for kids.
Excellent. That'd be wonderful advice. And we need to work on getting you in front of some of the principals.
yes, let's.
Okay. Well, and that brings me to a question then that I like to ask every one of my guests, which is, now we're completely off the topic of the books, but I like to ask you this. If you thought back to when you were in school as a student, it could be K through 12, college, whatever, was there a teacher you wish you could thank? And if so, who and why, and what would you say?
There are actually a couple of them. I can't remember the name. I know it'll come to me later, but my memory is notoriously horrible. In high school, don't remember what grade, but she just was very, very firm, and she took her work very seriously, and she took our work very seriously, and I just wanted to emulate her. But the one that stands out most in my mind, I do know, was Diane Lind, Miss Lind, from seventh grade. She was the drama coach back in the day when, you know, most schools had such things. Right. And I just loved her. I just loved her enthusiasm. And I'll never forget, this is one way in which my memory didn't fail me. I didn't get the role that I tried out for, but she made me her backstage assistant or whatever it was called. And I remember she told my mother how responsible I was. You see, she did help instill responsibility in me because she expected it. You know, I mean, it wasn't a question. She just handed me these responsibilities, and her expectations were that I could meet them. So She taught me responsibility, but she was telling my mother what a hard worker I was. And I think my mother did one of those cartoon double takes because I was not a hard worker at home. I hate housework, plain and simple. Always have, always will. So I was not doing a lot of housework at home. And my mother, hearing Miss Lind tell her, you know, Ray is such a hard worker, didn't quite know who she was talking about. But it was, you see, I was doing work that I loved, that I enjoyed, that was appreciated, for which there was much, much gratification. So there's the difference.
Yes, that's funny. There's a whole nother book in what you're just talking about, because there's always teachers, kids who the teachers will buy into, and most of it is because of what you just described, is that those teachers connect with them because they believe in them, and they understand, they understand them more than what many other adults have done, and so they'll turn to them, and they'll do way more for them than they will even at home.
Absolutely. And it was Miss Barry. It was Miss Barry who was the other one. I just remembered. Isn't that wonderful?
That is. Excellent. Got her name in there. Good stuff. Well, Ray, I can't thank you enough for spending time with me today. What if everybody understood child development? It's such a powerful book, and I strongly encourage teachers and administrators alike to find this book and learn from it and put some of those lessons that you talk about in there to use in action in school.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you so very much, Ray, and you have an awesome day.
Thank you.
Hello, listeners. We want to remind everyone to check out all of our digital content at teachinglearningleadingk12.com. That's teachinglearningleadingk12.com. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Just search Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 in the iTunes store. Check back often for updates and new material.
Hang tight, everyone. I'm going to let go of the wall.
You have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12. Recorded in Eastman, Georgia, at the Heart of Georgia Precinct.